good morning to you. My name's Libby Price. Great to have your company on a Country Breakfast on RN. The big news for rural Australia this week was the federal government finally announcing its drought assistance package for farmers. The Abbott government has gone back to the old system of low-interest loans for farmers in drought-declared areas. It's pretty much what farmers wanted, but it hasn't addressed rural business reliance on agriculture for income.
Any reserves any business had have gone. I thought I was pretty right, you know, 12 months. If I went 12 months without work, I'd be able to, you know, struggle on. Well, it's been 18 and I ran out of money, you know, 9 or 10 months ago. And it's just, yeah, it's nuts.
And of course, we'll be travelling the country with our rural reporters. But before that, let's find out what's been making the news this week with Kath McAloon. Good morning, Kath.
Good morning, Libby.
As I mentioned, the big announcement on drought.
That's right. And as you said, pretty much expected. Concessional loans, income support. There's also funding in there for mental health programs in the package that the federal government unveiled in Canberra this week. The government announced an extra $280 million will be pumped into the Farm Finance Concessional Loan Scheme. And also from March 3rd, it'll be easier for farmers to get access to income support payments through the interim farm household allowance. The assets test for those payments, which are similar to a New Start style payment, they'll be more generous than what's currently available, so more farmers will be able to get access to that. The government's also announced more money for water infrastructure. There's also $10 million for pest management, including tackling wild dogs. And in the worst drought affected states of Queensland and New South Wales, there's money for mental health programs. The National Farmers Federation has welcomed the package. Its chief executive, Matt Linegar, says farmers still really need a longer-term Commonwealth drought policy.
Since the millennium drought ended, we've had, well, we've had 3 or 4 years or more, and we still don't have that long-term solution. We are ready to go now. We are working with Minister Joyce on this issue. We can't wait another 4 years. We need to get this resolved over the coming months.
And some farmers aren't very impressed that really this is very much focused at Queensland and New South Wales.
That's right. In South Australia's far north, they're also experiencing a drought, and pastoralists there will say that they'll keep pushing for more drought assistance for their area. Some of those measures that have been announced won't extend to South Australia, so they won't get access to the funding for water infrastructure or the pest control. Grazier Colin Greenfield from South Australia's far north says farmers in that area are also experiencing drought and they do need help.
There's been as much, if not more, rainfall deficiency in parts of South Australia. It doesn't matter whether it's affecting 10,000 square k's or 1,000 square k's. If you're one of the ones being affected, you're as bad off as anyone else. I'm certainly not optimistic that we're going to get the same level of support as what producers in Queensland and New South Wales do.
And what the federal government didn't consider was helping small businesses that are reliant on agriculture for income.
That's right. There's been no funding for wage support schemes to keep rural workers employed. Lex Scotty manages a farm machinery business at Walgett in northwest New South Wales, and he says that businesses need government support too.
Yeah, we don't want a handout. Wage assistance, low interest loans, something where we can keep the doors open, keep our staff on. We're down to a crew of 14 very experienced staff, and we can't really drop below that figure, because the problem we have in small country towns is once you lose them, they're gone.
We'll be hearing a little bit more from Lex Scotty and some other small businesses around northwest New South Wales later on a Country Breakfast. In other news this week, it's extraordinary when you put this into perspective. The Murray-Darling Basin Plan we've been talking about for nearly 8 years. Mm. It was initiated by the Howard government. Finally, all the states have signed.
That's right. New South Wales and Queensland have finally joined the other states and territories within that Murray-Darling Basin, and they've signed up to a plan to protect the river system. New South Wales had been holding out on signing up to the implementation agreement. They were insisting that the Commonwealth cap buybacks. They wanted it capped to 3% per valley per decade, but they've now dropped that condition. They've agreed that the government's commitment to cap buybacks at 1,500 gigalitres basin-wide will offer sufficient protection. That state will also get an extra $4 million out of the $100 million Federal Regional Economic Diversification Fund. The Federal Parliamentary Secretary for the Environment, Simon Birmingham, says it doesn't mean that other states are missing out.
Other states still get a pretty good cut of that, $25 million each to Victoria and South Australia and $15 million to Queensland. So a good news story for New South Wales, but certainly this hasn't been a squabble about money as much as it's been about a commitment of how the water will be recovered in a way that preserves the economic future of basin communities.
Now to that controversial subject of live animal exports, and the Department of Agriculture has this week had to admit to quite a few welfare breaches.
Yeah, the department released three reports this week into alleged welfare breaches, one in Jordan, one in Malaysia, and another one related to deaths of animals that were in transit to both Japan and Malaysia. Now, the Agriculture Department is saying that its current powers to enforce animal welfare in live export markets are sufficient, despite these latest reports, but it admits that it doesn't mean that regulating behaviour in a foreign country is an easy thing to do. One report found that exporter Livestock Shipping Services failed to comply with SCAS rules in one incident in Jordan. That company has now been restricted to just one supply chain in Jordan that's been approved by the government to take Australian livestock. The Agriculture Department Deputy Secretary Philip Glyde insists that the regulator does have the tools to do its job.
Very satisfied with those powers. We've got a range of administrative powers that we can have in relation to consignments and also to licences, but there's also some criminal sanctions in some of our acts as well. So the range is there. I think the thing I'd point out, it is quite difficult to regulate behaviour in another country. We have no authority in that other country.
Talking about live animal exports, and we've had our first shipment of live buffalo.
Yeah, this is being seen as a bit of a new market for the Northern Territory buffalo industry, which has been struggling in recent years. The Northern Territory's Chief Minister, Adam Giles, is touring importing facilities in Vietnam's northeast province, where there are now more than 200 Northern Territory buffalo awaiting processing at a local abattoir there. Mr. Giles says the animals arrive safely and subsequent shipments have already left Darwin.
The buffalo made it. They were treated, I wouldn't say treated with luxury, but there was a shipment, I believe, on Monday, which left Darwin with around 400 buffalo on it. And in April, there'll be another 1,500. So they are slowly finding their way through the supply chain process and out onto the market.
And if buffalo aren't exotic enough, we're also exporting alpacas.
A herd of pregnant alpacas is being flown out of Sydney to establish a new industry in Turkey. The export is the first deal with the Turkish government to breed high-quality alpacas for both their fibre and meat. A much larger herd will follow later this year. Milpaca stud breeder Ian Frith says a Turkish university has spent $100,000 to start the project.
We will shear them and show them how to shear them when we arrive. We'll take our shearing gear with us and everything. They'll be shorn, the fleece will be bagged so they can study the fleece off these for their mills too to know what they're doing with the micron. And in 6 months' time, there's another 250 booked to go over.
I always get a little bit nervous when I hear stories about biological control, but hopefully these caterpillars won't prove too much of a problem.
There's an awful lot of them. 20,000 caterpillars have been released across northern Australia in an attempt to control Parkinsonia weed. Parkinsonia is spreading rapidly and it's competing with native pastures and lowering the productivity of cattle stations. The caterpillar, which is known as the Parkinsonian lupa, is originally from Mexico and it was selected through a biological weed control program funded by Meat and Livestock Australia. MLA's Wayne Hall says the caterpillar passed strict quarantine tests before being released.
They're leaf caterpillars, so they eat the leaf of the plant. And there's very good signs at this particular point in time. No one wants to introduce another cane toad into the country. And so we're certain that what we do introduce as biocontrol agents will only impact on those weeds that we're worried about and not on native plants or other species.
I have a vision of pillar cats, as my nephew calls them, sitting at desks doing a quarantine test with mini little pens. It's been a bumper tuna season in South Australia.
It's being described as one of the best in decades, but it was also one of the shortest. Fishing of the tuna has finished more than a month ahead of usual. Industry spokesman Brian Jeffress says it's due to an abundance of fish closer into shore.
Fantastic. Normally we would have fished from December to end of March and we finished in early February. The fish we caught are highly targeted fish. In other words, we let a lot go by until we found the type of fish we want. It's the best fishing I've seen since the 1990s and certainly the highest quality that I've ever seen.
Now we have a list of Australia's 10 top favourite meals. Mine is roast lamb.
It might not be the most environmentally friendly meal, though, Libby.
Oh, dear.
A list has been compiled of Australia's top 10 favourite meals, and it's been ranked according to their environmental impact. It compared foods like roast lamb, which is also my favourite, and prawns on the barbie, and it looked at how much water, land and resources are needed to produce them. Christian Reynolds is a PhD student at the University of South Australia. He put this list together, and he says that lamb roast came out as having the biggest impact, while bangers and mash and kangaroo were softer on the environment. But he says it's not quite as simple as that.
The average size of a lamb roast is 2 kilos, but bangers and mash is, you know, 150 grams of sausage per person. And the reason for that, of course, is because you get leftovers from a lamb roast, which you can have the next couple of days, as I'm sure all your listeners are aware. I definitely do that. And so these footprints are a good indicator of environmental effect, but you've got to take them with a grain of salt because there could be other things happening there to do with our own food culture and traditions.
Fancy doing all that research and then saying take it with a grain of salt. I am taking it with more than a grain of salt with my roast lamb. Kath McAloon, thank you.
Thanks, Libby.
Kath McAloon with this week's Rural News. Rural Reporter is next.
On By Design this morning, you'll meet architect, educator, one-time revolutionary and one of the founding members of the UK group Archigram, Sir Peter Cook.
And then at 9:30 on RN First Bite, how do we food brand Australia when our Indigenous ingredients aren't mainstream? Can we define ourselves on the global stage?
That's By Design and RN First Bite.
Your new Saturday morning lineup.
From 9 here on RN.
You're listening to A Country Breakfast on RN. Let's get out and about with our rural reporters. This week, City Slickers head bush to take part in one of Australia's largest ever cattle drives. We meet a man with a passion for collecting old shearing handpieces, and we find out about growing the bush tucker fruit, the kwandong, in Alice Springs. And we visit a suburban backyard in Brisbane where Ross Kendall has his hands full breeding and selling butterflies.
What happens in here is the butterflies fly.
Yeah.
They mate. They lay their eggs. We collect the eggs, and then it's all about feeding hungry caterpillars.
Lots of hungry mouths to feed by the sounds of things. The world of butterfly farming later on Country Breakfast. But let's start today in the long paddock in outback New South Wales, where a mob of cattle is slowly making its way south to hay.
We are Sydney siders, but we love rural Australia. Everybody out here is very friendly, so I didn't think it would take me much to find out whether we could join them. I suppose it was a little audacious at one level because it's inviting yourself into someone else's world. But everyone was very friendly and very helpful.
There's not many kids from inner city Sydney who can claim to have taken part in one of Australia's biggest ever cattle drives. But 8-year-old Jack and 6-year-old Meg Stapleton can. While holidaying in Western New South Wales, the family joined a droving team for a couple of days. Hello, I'm Cherie McDonald. The cattle in question are owned by South Australian pastoralist Tom Brinkworth and are part of an 18,000-strong herd he bought from the Australian Agricultural Company last year. The cattle were split into 9 mobs and have walked for months along stock routes through Queensland and New South Wales to reach their final destination, a journey of some 2,000 kilometres. For the Stapleton family, the chance to join the droving team was an opportunity not to be missed, as Dad Giles explains.
I've got 2 children, 8-year-old son and a 6-year-old daughter, and for them we just thought it would be an amazing start to a trip. We turned up sort of along around this corner and we saw a mob of about 1,300 cows, and then we saw the drover on his quad bike and then his assistant, who was an Aboriginal man, and his name was Theo, and we basically were invited into that group. The kids and I were basically allowed to use the quad. I was driving the quad across the road from side to side with my kids, one on the front, one on the back.
Now, you said that you are the son of a farmer, an English farmer. Did you grow up with a lot of cattle and sheep?
Most of my life on the farm was arable farming, so there was not a lot of stock, but for 2 or 3 years in my early years there was, and so I did spend some time in cattle yards and moving cows onto and off trucks and stuff like that. The Australian countryside fascinates all 4 of us, and so we just tend to go out and explore.
My name is Jack. I was very amazed to see that just 2 people could muster that many cows.
And what was it like being up so close to the big cows?
Very scary, because they look like bulls.
And did you have a bit of a chat to the drover?
Yes. We asked him a bit of questions of how long it would take him to get there, to get from where he was, where we were, to hay.
Now, did you get to meet some of the working dogs that were also helping to move the animals along?
Tigger, Ted, yes, and they were very noisy.
Meg, Stapleton. Bit frightening because there was a lot, 1,300 or something. Very exciting.
Now, Liz, you were also part of this journey. What was it like for you to see so many animals and being involved with something that's quite extraordinary?
It's a completely unique experience for me and for the family. Both Giles and I are both imports to Australia. We're both from England. Our kids are both born in Australia. And for the last 2 or 3 years, we've always made a point of coming to the outback for holidays.
It must have been extraordinary for you to join the cattle run and to see literally what would look like a sea of cows.
It was a sea of cows. I remember the first morning we were there when he let them out of their little pen that they'd been in overnight, and we all started hiding behind the bushes because this rush of cows came past us. And everyone was a little bit worried about whether they would be chasing us or anything. And I think through the day we realised that wasn't the case, and we realised they're quite a gentle mob, and they truly ambled along and took things at their own pace. But yes, that first viewing of all the different cows all kind of rushing along was quite impressive and will stay with us for a long time, I think.
Now, you've said that you've had some experience in rural life, in outback life, before this opportunity. But was there something that really stood out for you?
I think the drover we were with, I'm sure he was one of many that are all very similar, but we were very impressed by his... He's such a young lad, and he was in charge of these 1,300 cattle. He formed a great team with his workmate Theo, and they just were so calm and so patient. They travel 10 kilometres a day. And it took all day, and it was so hard. You know, my guys that spent their morning on the quad bike were exhausted at the end of the morning, and they were covered in grime, and they wanted to do was go and jump in the nearest swimming pool. But James and Theo were there the whole day, and that was just all they did. And they sat for hours just waiting by the waterhole for the cattle to have sufficient to drink. So just beautiful people and just beautiful nature about them.
And did you sit around the campfire at night and share a few city country yarns?
Absolutely, yes. We got our 2 children to bed so that Giles and I could go off to spend some time with James and Theo and share a bottle of red and just chat to them about why they were doing it, why they'd chosen this way of life. We just, again, Giles and I find it a truly unique time to try and understand what people go through on a daily basis.
So you sound like you had a fantastic experience. Any chance you might be packing up your city house and moving to the outback anytime soon?
You know what, every time we come out here, Giles and I always spend the return journey chatting about what we could do out here and how we could make our living out here and what it would be like. And Yes, we still haven't done it yet. We're still retaining that city house for a few more years.
What I'm holding here is actually an Allen hand piece. It's the only known one in the world, and it was produced in the US.
Kevin Crook loves his sheep. In fact, he loves everything to do with the sheep industry. But his fascination goes much further than just running this merino stud near Oyen in Victoria's northwest. Kevin is a collector of antique shearing equipment, and this back shed is crammed full of handpieces and other memorabilia. Hello, I'm Sophie Malcolm, and Kevin's going to give me a crash course in the history of the shearing industry and the equipment used over the years, not just here in Australia, but overseas as well.
As I said before, it's the only known one in the world. There may be other ones out there, but in all the collectors in the world, it's the only one that's ever been seen. Oh, it's probably, might be close on 10 years ago now. I just saw a few old handpieces one day and I thought, oh, they're very interesting, because we've always had sheep and shearers here. So I just started collecting a few, and originally I thought there might have only been sort of 20 to 30 different ones. But 220 later, we're still finding them.
So 220 handpieces. What other types of equipment do you have in your collection?
We've got a lot of blades, which even go back pre-handpiece, back into the 1850s. Cooper notebooks, which I think the oldest one we've got here is 1909. I think there's one before that. And just all other little drench guns and anything to do with the sheep industry, really. Anything small, nothing too large. I think we've got about 13 or 14 different shearing plants, and any little notebooks and advertising material from years ago. They all actually go. We have tried using a few of the old ones, but they bang and crunch and rattle a bit more than the modern handpiece.
Is there anything that stands out as a particular favourite?
Yeah, there's about three or four favourite handpieces I've got. Yeah, some from overseas, some from Australia. We've got a couple here that are the only known ones in the world, so they're probably my favourite. Well, this handpiece I've got here, this is an experimental Wolseley that was produced in 1888, and that was used at Dunlop Station, the first shed in Australia to go large overhead shearing, or full-on machine shearing. A little bit different to other ones, and just the history of that handpiece is amazing, because it actually came from Dunlop Station at Louth in New South Wales.
So tell me, where do you get them from? How do you sort of go about building your collection?
From other collectors. If you're lucky enough to find something that someone else is desperate for, you can usually swap a few pieces. Auctions, internet, everywhere really.
Now we're looking at probably maybe a case of 25 or so handpieces here. Give us a bit of a run through of, I guess, a 101 of handpiece collection. What should we be looking out for if we want to build our own collection?
Usually the rarer ones are all brass, because they are experimental handpieces, and the older the better usually. But there is one handpiece that was made from roughly 1890s to about 1930s, which is called the Wolseley No. 3. And believe it or not, they're worth about $30 each. That's all. But some of the other ones in the same period are probably worth, you know, thousands.
What do you love so much about collecting them?
Oh, just the history of the whole sheep industry is amazing. What it's been through with the unions and the shearers and the wide gear and the narrow gear, and then back to wide gear again. And, yeah, it's the further you get into it, the more exciting it is.
And I suppose you can see that all sort of played out through the equipment here.
Yeah, well, I'd love to be up the talk if there'd be some wonderful stories of some of the handpieces, what they've been through and where they've been.
Now, you're talking before about there being a bit of a community of people who collect shearing equipment and handpieces. Tell me a bit about that.
Yeah, it's just a group of people who sort of, with like interests, I suppose, and they're all over the world. There's a couple of very keen collectors in New Zealand, another couple in the UK. You know, we communicate with fairly often and swap handpieces between all of us. It's the characters you meet along, some of the old shearers, and when you go to collect gear. It's just interesting, and it's a very good way of meeting extra people.
They're reluctant to part with their gear?
Some are, but some are quite happy to know that their handpieces or all their old shearing gear is going into a collection that people, you know, can get a look at occasionally.
I don't know that you could fit many more in here. What are you kind of working towards with your collection?
Well, just keep working till we've exhaust all the handpieces that are known in the world, really, all the different ones. We can always make more room or more boxes.
There's always room for one more when you're a collector. Kevin Crook from Oyen in northwest Victoria showing Sophie Malcolm around his shearing memorabilia collection. Still to come on Rural Reporter today, we're farming butterflies in Brisbane and growing kwandongs in Alice Springs.
Wherever you look around here,
you will always see a Kwandong tree, or not a Kwandong tree, but you might see 10. You see one to your left, and you see one at the back, and there, everywhere.
They sure are. They're everywhere. In fact, on this small rural block in Alice Springs in Central Australia, there's more than 500 Kwandong trees. Hello, I'm Caddy Brain, and the bush tucker, Kwandong, also known as native peach, is notoriously difficult to grow well, but Gunnar Nielsen appears to have the knack. What started as a hobby 10 years ago has turned into a bit of an obsession, and he's got plans to produce the shiny red fruit on a commercial scale soon. But Gunnar's plantation doesn't look like you might expect. There's no straight lines or rows. The trees stand in pairs all over the property. I'll get Gunnar to explain why.
That one there has got this one as a host plant. And the host plant is a olive tree. It's actually a parasite. Yeah.
So it attaches to the roots?
Yes, that's how it works. And any other tree will do it, pretty much.
What does a Kwandong actually look like?
That looks like a mini golf ball, bright red like a Coca-Cola can, shiny as anything. And really the way to see it is in September months. And on the tree, it looks fantastic.
How long have you been planting them?
I've kept going and going for over 10 years now, because everyone said, them days, don't do that. It's a waste of your time. Show them all. Well, I can do whatever I like. And so I did.
So you plant a few more each year?
Yes. And because I do my own propagation, then it sort of does not really cost anything. If I had to buy them through a nursery, there could be no change out of $50,000. Absolutely none whatsoever.
So a tree like this, which must be over 4 metres in height...
That's more than 4 metres, yeah.
Maybe even 5. Yeah. How many fruit would this one tree produce?
I'm not sure, but I would say it would be 15 kilos. Could be more.
So of all these trees, do you know what your total yield was for last year?
No. I know I should keep more record on things, but, you know, we only got so much time and got to go to work too and all that sort of thing, so... We just
work
do.
Always gets in the way of growing things, doesn't it?
Yeah, but that's what we do. That's what we do.
So of these kilogram after kilogram of Kwandongs, what did you do with them?
A lot of it, just give away and that sort of things. There's one, the next road up here, he organised to Yulara out there, something like 80 kilos to be prepared in the restaurant or whatever they got going there, so. I don't know.
You're just giving it away, or are you selling a bit as well?
I'm hoping to sell it future-wise, like to sell it, or maybe I'll make my own products of some sort.
First you've got to get it up to scale.
Yeah, get it all up to scale, everything. As they say, like anything else in life, you've got to be able to crawl before you can walk.
Because it's got a variety of uses, doesn't it? You can use it as a spice, in cooking, but also in jewellery.
Yeah, the seeds you can use for jewellery. And you can use it for, just making more trees.
Because it's not easy, I hear. There's a few secrets involved.
It's very tricky. There's a few little things you've got to be aware of. You do not have to be a professor to work it out.
But you're not going to tell us, are you?
Maybe one day.
How did you get so interested in Kwandongs in particular, though?
Because it's a challenge. Anyone can grow a... lemon tree or whatever, you just bung it in the ground, a bit of water, and it grows. Kwandong tree is different. You've got to really keep eye on things and not nurse them too much and this and that, because that kills them too. So, yeah, it's a challenge.
Now, I understand you've made a big purchase recently for your Kwandongs. Can you show us it?
Yeah. Just have a bit of a look at the machinery here. That's a, comes from down south. It's called an apricot cutting machine. They actually cuts them up and takes the seed out. Still needs a little bit more modification because Kwandongs are actually smaller fruit than apricot.
So where exactly did this come from?
It comes from, I think it's called Waikerie down south. Because what happens down south is apricot farms stop growing apricots because they can import from Turkey for half the price. So therefore no one wants to buy Australian apricots, which is very sad. as you know, everyone only look at the price. So, and a lot of the farmers down south, they're just bulldozing their orchards and then flogging their machinery off.
That's created an opportunity for you.
So it has. Not that I should sit there and think you're beauty, because what about the farmer down there? This is actually the cutting blades here. So all the fruit goes on here and then it runs there. And the seed gets cut out, just like that. And what happens then after that? I just turn them off. Then it runs down here. And the rest of the fruit goes up this thing here. And there you are. There you are. Because as we get more fruit growing here, I don't know if it's because we get lazy or what, we just want it easier. But I decided I want it easier, because otherwise you could spend 24 hours a day peeling and picking and all that sort of things there. So I know what to do when it's September. Don't go fishing in September. Stay home.
This is the cathedral. I built this 12, 13 years ago. Come on in.
Whoops. Ooh, don't get out.
Wait till she flies away. That's the orchard swallowtail butterfly.
Tucked away in this suburban backyard in Queensland is a large netted enclosure filled with plants and flowers. And among all this greenery are butterflies. Lots and lots of butterflies, and even more very hungry caterpillars.
What happens in here is the butterflies fly.
Yeah.
They mate. They lay their eggs. We collect the eggs. And then it's all about feeding hungry caterpillars. Feeding the butterflies is easy. You see, we have some flowers.
It's the caterpillars that are the challenge.
Caterpillars are the big munchers.
Oh, here's a female.
Hello, I'm Miriam Hall, and today I'm visiting Ross Kendall's butterfly farm in inner-city Brisbane. This former teacher has turned a lifetime interest into a business, supplying butterflies for weddings and even funerals.
That's a female, and she would be looking for the right plant to lay the eggs on, and there are quite a few of the right plants in here for her.
Look at that orange one.
That's the monarch or wanderer. He's not really a true Aussie, only got here in about 1860. As the Americans call them, the monarch. I just noticed up here on that tip, you see the black and blue one?
Mm-hmm.
That's called the blue tiger.
They're so beautiful, aren't they? And what are those yellow ones?
That's the yellow migrant. And the key thing is that you've got to have the correct plants for them to lay their eggs on. We call those the host plants, and if you don't have the right host plant, they won't lay their egg. I've always been interested, but about 15 years ago I got this idea of, as a frustrated teacher, to do something so kids could experience the butterfly life cycle. Not see it on video or whatever, but the reality. And so I developed what I call my live learning kit. So I had a website. And then people contacted me and said, can we get some butterflies for release at weddings, which was, I think, an American thing. So I started to raise more butterflies and supply them for weddings.
Did you ever think that you'd be able to make money out of butterflies?
Probably not.
It's interesting that the wedding thing has taken off. What kind of things do people want?
Well, they want butterflies to release at part of the ceremony or afterwards. And another thing is for funerals and memorials. And I supply lots of butterflies. Unfortunately, they're usually short notice, and sometimes I just don't have the butterflies.
And what do people want? Do they say, I want a certain type of butterfly, I want a certain colour? Do you have bridezillas to deal with?
Sometimes, yes. I try to teach them the reality of you can't always have them on cue at the right time.
You said that you started out with the live learning kits. Why did you want children to have the opportunity to see the cycle?
I believe that most kids these days are too remote from reality. They don't get out into the bush. They don't see the living things. It's an electronic age, and teachers tell me it just transforms the classroom when they have them there.
Really?
Yeah. The kids even name the caterpillars. Now, how you can tell one caterpillar from the next, I don't know.
It's interesting you say, you know, we're living in an electronic age and so many gadgets and so many learning tools and so many different ways to do things, but still a butterfly can just capture a heart of a child.
Oh, yes. Well, they see them as caterpillars and then they, of course, metamorphose into the pupa or chrysalis, and then they see them emerge and pump up their wings and great excitement.
Butterflies began as an interest for you. What is it about the butterflies that you like so much?
They are non-threatening, they're colourful, they're universally, people love butterflies. And, of course, in nature, they are, if you like, ecological markers, you know, of a healthy environment when there's lots of butterflies around and other insects. I think they're just part of our whole biosphere.
So a few fast facts about butterflies. People often say they live for a day. Is that true?
Absolutely not. No, butterflies live for weeks and months.
Really?
Yeah. Eventually their wings wear out usually. Yeah, and eventually a bird or something gets them. There are no foreign butterflies. There were a couple of migrants. There's the cabbage white, arrived in Australia in about the 1930s. The monarch, they don't know how it got here, or the wanderer as we used to call it. They got here in about 1860. And only last year, a butterfly appeared up in the Northern Territory, which used to be found in Sri Lanka and India. And over the last 20 years, it's moved progressively across Southeast Asia and arrived in Australia last year.
It's so restful in your cathedral, as you call it. Do you ever just go and sit there and enjoy the butterflies?
No, I never seem to make time to do that.
Really? So what's the passion if you can't enjoy them?
Well, I still enjoy them, as in, of course, but just to sit and do nothing, I think, is not in my nature.
Inner city farmer Ross Kendall supplying butterflies for weddings, even funerals across the country. And a big thank you to Miriam Hall for that report. You're listening to A Country Breakfast. I'm Libby Price. Coming up, small businesses in rural Australia say they need drought assistance too.
On Saturday Extra this week, a compare and contrast between our own times and that of an era most of us like to parody as uptight, frightened of sex, unimaginative, the Victorian era. But Simon Heffer, the Daily Mail commentator, has pored over it and thinks it was exactly the opposite to live through, full of advances and high-mindedness. He'll explain why and what he thinks it could tell us. Plus, debt and modern China. What do we need to know? All after 7.30 here on RN.
The big news for rural Australia this week was the federal government finally announcing its drought assistance package for farmers. It's thrown out the plan that was trialled in Western Australia by the Labor government, which focused more on farmers being better prepared for drought. Instead, the Abbott government's gone back to the old system of low-interest loans for farmers in drought-declared areas. Queensland producers are divided over whether the drought assistance will even make a difference. 70% of that state, around 6,500 farms, are currently in drought, and recent patchy rain has done little to ease the situation. Lydia Burton reports.
Graziers in western and northwest Queensland seem to be most vocal about the federal government's changes to concessional loans. Hannah Haken helps run the family cattle property north of Cloncurry. She says even a 2% rate cut could be beneficial for struggling businesses.
Everyone is at different interest rates depending on your risk level. So those people that are really heavily geared will probably have a higher interest rate. So that will be substantial for them. Whereas, I mean, some people are paying around 6%. So even a 2% rate cut is great. It's a great outcome.
Carly Walker is from Rio, south of Longreach, and is unsure at this stage exactly what the announcement means for her family. She says the original concessional loan scheme was of no use to her business. However, with a lower interest rate, they are more likely to consider it.
The last time I looked into these concessional loans, it wasn't going to be something that, well, we didn't apply. There was virtually no difference between the interest rate we were paying and that interest rate, and it would have been a massive amount of paperwork, so we didn't worry about it. I guess I'll have a look at it again this time and see if the conditions have changed. If they've changed, we'd certainly look at applying to ease that side of things.
However, others are outright opposed to the package. The Mayor of Cloncurry, Andrew Daniels, believes the federal government can do more, and it's not acting in the best interests of agriculture.
It's very disappointing, actually. The fact that they've dropped the interest by 0.5% is actually nothing. If you want to borrow that amount of money at 4%, the government will be making money out of the farmers. Well, the cash rate being 2.5%, I'm sure the federal government could borrow money at 3%. So, you know, they're lending it out at 4%. That's a pretty scary factor that not a lot of people have taken up the concessional loans anyway that the federal government put on the table 6 or 7 months ago. So there's a lot of work involved in getting that concessional loan. The reality of it is in 5 years' time, you have to give it back to your major bank, whoever you borrow the money off. And the other reality of it is that people in the bush are pretty loyal people. And I think that it's sad to see that people might leave their banks in a small community like Cloncurry. They leave their bank, which, you know, keeps our economy rolling over. I'm very, very disappointed that there's actually been no real money introduced into this drought package. Real money being actual money that will make a difference, that'll kickstart economies. And we pleaded and begged Barnaby Joyce to consider the rate option, and that probably would have ended up being cheaper than the $340 million, but the reality of it is it would have been real money, and the government's put forward the $340 million, and it's only monopoly money.
Mayor of Cloncurry, Andrew Daniels, speaking there with Lydia Burton. Well, the drought package offers nothing to regional businesses reliant on agriculture. Western Plains reporter Sally Bryant talked to several struggling business owners in Walgett in northwest New South Wales, where there hasn't been any decent rain for nearly 2 years. First stop, Walgett Tyre Service, where Sally spoke to manager Lex Scotty.
There certainly will be a flow-on effect at some stage to us, but the most critical thing we need out here is rain, and nothing but substantial rain. Disappointing that small business in rural centres like Walgett are not getting mentioned and any assistance to us. We're certainly not looking for handouts, but, you know, we employ 14 people here with families, and it's a major flow-on effect to the town with our staff generating income for the shops, etc. in the town, and I'm just hoping that we're not going to be forgotten about.
How long has it been since there's been a good harvest at Walgett?
We got very lucky in 2012. We started the year with subsoil moisture, and that's really when the drought started, the lack of rain. And we got lucky with some rainfalls that got a crop in. We had nothing last year, virtually nothing out of 1 million acres of farming. I would imagine there might have been 150,000 acres planted, and of that there might have been another maybe 50,000 acres of that strip. So, yeah, virtually nothing last year.
So what sort of impact has that had on this business?
Oh, absolutely disastrous. Yeah, horrific. Our sales of new machinery and second-hand machinery have probably hit a rock bottom since 2009. We've never experienced anything like this. I've been doing this for 35 years and been through three of these horrific droughts, and this is probably the worst I've ever seen.
So how do you get on keeping your staff on?
Oh, the goodwill of our owners. At the end of the day, at the moment, we're not probably crying poor, but in the same token, we certainly would be only just making wages to keep the doors open, and the flow-on effect from that is, of course, the farmers aren't generating income. And, you know, it's just a tough time for everyone involved.
So how long do you think this business will be able to keep supporting itself without good general rain, without crops?
Oh, that's an impossible situation for me to answer. Certainly, Lex and Ashley Webster, who own our business, certainly probably don't even want to look at that at this stage, and we're hoping we're going to get substantial rains out of this change coming this weekend and hopefully following from that. So we've got a crop. We've got to stay positive. We've just got to keep staying positive. It's going to rain, and we're going to get, you know, the only thing stopping us from getting going is rain.
So you say that it's a bit disappointing that businesses in country towns are not getting some support. What sort of support do you think the federal or state governments could reasonably give you to help you keep you going until you get good rain?
Well, I'm an employee, but, you know, if I was in their position, you know, low interest rate loans. Yeah, we don't want a handout. You know, wage assistance, low interest loans, something where we can keep the doors open, keep our staff on. We're down to a crew of 14 very experienced staff, and we can't really drop below that figure because the problem we have in small country towns is once you lose them, they're gone. They're gone. You know, 12 months ago we had a staff of 24, with a bit of natural attrition. We've only had to put off one guy because of it all. But, you know, once we lose them, we lose them. Out of the town. They're gone from the town. So the whole town is affected because there's no work here. So they move on to other towns.
Luke Scotty, manager of Walgett Tyre Services, which also sells farm machinery. Hunter Hopcraft runs an agricultural spraying business in Walgett. He thought he'd planned ahead, but as he told Sally Branch, the drought has blown that plan to pieces.
Hunter, you've got a spraying business. Things would be pretty quiet for you at the moment.
Yeah, I've had a pretty big spraying business here. It's halved in size in the last 18 months, and I've still got a couple of major machines I'm trying to pay off with no work, yeah.
How long have you been running your business here at Walgett?
24 years, thereabouts.
And you would have seen some good times, and you would have also seen some pretty ordinary seasons.
Yeah, we've been through drought before. I can't remember it being this bad, but then I guess the repayments have never been this big. That's what's made this one hard.
So in the last really busy time, when you had last boomer season, how many machines were you running? How many guys you were employing? What sort of size business were you running?
I was running 4 spray rigs, two blokes for each of those, and I've got a little earth moving side of my business as well, so it's 3 there. So, you know, 18 months, 2 years ago, I had 12 blokes employed. Now I've got 3.
And as you say, you've also got the capital cost of that equipment. You're paying stuff off.
Yeah, well, the work stopped, but the payments haven't. So we keep trying to make the payments. I've sold nearly everything out of my yard to try and keep the good gear.
So is there any work around Walgett at the moment for you?
I'm getting some earthworks with the bobcats and excavators and things, desilting dams and that sort of thing, but earthwork will never make the payments on the spray rigs. The spray rigs are just phenomenal.
How are you managing to keep things ticking over?
Well, just been in a steady decline for 18 months, so just getting towards the end now. You see, hopefully it'll rain shortly, but if it doesn't rain, I'll be looking for a job.
Yeah. If you were going to be seeking any support, any help from either the federal or state government, can you think of a way that they could assist you to keep your business ticking over until we get a good season and when, you know, farmers will come looking for you again?
Low interest loans, easy, works. All we've got to do is approve the money and approve the clientele, and it's a done deal. It's not a handout.
What interest rate are you paying on your money?
6% and 7% on machinery, and pretty much the same with overdrafts. Well, overdrafts 12%, but and of course, when you're in this position, all your credit cards are used up pretty well, and yeah, that's about 22%. So, yeah, it'd be nice to take some pressure off there.
So it's expensive money, isn't it?
Very expensive money. It's really hard to get through these times. You just hope it rains tomorrow, but who knows?
How is your business structured? During a really good time, are you managing to put stuff away? Are you managing to build up a bit of a reserve to prepare for these times?
Well, we do, but we haven't had any significant rain in Walgett for 18 months, and some blokes would say 2 years. So any reserves any business had have gone. I thought I was pretty right, you know, 12 months. If I went 12 months without work, I'd be able to, you know, struggle on. Well, it's been 18 and I ran out of money, you know, 9 or 10 months ago, and it's just, yeah, it's nuts.
Hunter Hopcraft, who runs an agricultural spraying business in Walgett. Now, with so many farmers carrying a lot of debt, many are reliant on the value of their land as equity. And the good news is farms in southeastern Australia have been steadily increasing in value. Rural Finance Victoria has crunched the numbers on more than 40,000 farm sales over the past 2 decades. General Manager of Agribusiness Andrew Smith says farms have more than doubled in value.
If you do look at the various periods over the past 23 years, that first decade of the 1990s was really quite a flat period. Land values were quite stagnant in terms of both per hectare values, but also the volume of land sold.
What do you put that down to?
Look, it was a period of structural adjustment. There were certainly periods of drought through that decade, and that certainly had an impact. But also commodity prices were quite flat and the returns to agriculture weren't as strong as they are today, which goes to the point around farmer confidence levels and the willingness to expand and purchase land. So I think there was a number of factors there.
Then, around 2000, a rapid increase, like a big catch-up for the next 8 years.
Yeah, quite a significant, you'd almost say a spike in land values over that 8 years of data. It really was pre the global financial crisis. We did see a lot of structural adjustment with the number of farmers in Australia reducing, but the size of those farmers certainly increasing quite markedly over that eight-year period. It was a period where there was good support in terms of the financial system funding people to expand. Interest rates were reasonably low and really did see a push up in land values with, I think, an expectation that the future was pretty bright.
Then the global financial crisis and things have plateaued again.
Yeah, I think clearly when you look at the numbers, 08 was a point of correction. You know, no surprises in that with certainly the trend around interest rates rising. We had the stock market falls. We had commodity price falls across most of the commodity groups, and it really did correct itself. So 08 was certainly a point of change. And then the later part of that five-year cycle, we've started to see a pickup in confidence again. I think the numbers for 2013 were up 5% on 2012, which was up 8% on the year before that.
That's so the number of sales?
That's the actual values on the index started to pick up again in those last 2 years.
Because in some enterprises, there hasn't been that sort of pickup, has there?
No. Look, if you look across the various industries, dairy was one where we did see a major correction in 08 and some improvement in 2011, but then settling back again in 2012 and last year started to improve. So dairy is one example of obviously going through a tighter patch. Our cropping land has been pretty strong through that five-year period.
And that's interesting because a lot of that would be in the Mallee, a large percentage compared with other areas is between families, so it's family members buying each other out.
Yeah, that was quite an interesting insight when we get into the data that we were able to look at those family sales. And the Mallee, which doesn't surprise when you look at the landscape there, but the Mallee was predominated by, I think, 21% of the sales in the Mallee over that 23 years were to family members. Natural farm expansion and succession happening there within family groups.
And overall, what kind of farming country over the last two decades has done better?
It's an interesting one. If you look back at that 20-odd year sort of average annual growth, we across the state it saw an average annual growth of 4.2% over the 23 years. Within that period, certainly dairy industry in South and West Gippsland stood out as the highest growth per annum. I think it was close on 5%. And at the other end, we've seen areas of East Gippsland in the grazing sector that were running at less than 2%. So contrasts across the state.
This is, of course, very important because with so many farmers carrying debt, it's the equity in the farm and the growth in the land value that's keeping some afloat.
Look, a fair comment. I think if you look at farmer balance sheets over the past 20 years, we've certainly seen almost a doubling in land value for those balance sheets, and that obviously plays to strengthening equity. But through a period there of drought and some tighter returns, it really has been important to stabilise land values, given that some of the operating returns have been pretty flat.
If you compare it with the 80s, one good thing out of this is that when we have been in difficult times, the prices haven't collapsed. The properties might be difficult to sell, but they hold their value much better than they did in the 80s.
Great point, Libby. I think when you look at that index, it talks really to levels of growth, but then plateauing. So it does tend to stabilise. We haven't seen a period of sustained decline at all through that 23-year cycle, whereas, as you say, in the 80s, it was very marked that year on year you could see quite wild fluctuation and indeed reduction in values between a number of the sectors that we're talking about.
Rural Finance General Manager of Agribusiness, Andrew Smith. And that's all we have time for today. If you'd like to take a look at some of the photographs or read some more of the news stories, even listen back to a podcast of the program, just head to our website at abc.net.au/rural. Great to have your company this morning, and thanks to our technical producer, Melissa May. On RN, I'm Libby Price. Talk to you next week on A Country Breakfast.